No, in the end, we did not have Vladimir Putin making the trip to Turkey for that mano a mano that was on offer. Instead, in what's possibly a worse snub than an empty chair, the Russian president dispatching his former culture minister, the greater Russia ideologue Vladimir Medinsky. This for the first face-to-face negotiations with Ukrainians since 2022. We'll get an update. What's the Trump administration's next move after pushing so hard for a summit? We know Zelensky's next move is traveling to Ankara, which he did, instead of Istanbul, where the Ukrainian president met his Turkish counterpart. Turkey, whose star power is on the rise, with its influence unseating that of Moscow's in neighboring Syria. And Trump heaping praise on a fellow NATO ally. Turkey, whose role as a Black Sea arbiter and arms exporter could prove crucial. Then there's Ukraine's European allies talking tougher on sanctions and nuclear deterrence. Part of that's about Putin, part of it about Trump. Emmanuel Macron also this week speaking of territorial concessions. The idea that the time for talks is indeed approaching. If so, what do the likes of Paris, London, Berlin, Warsaw and friends have to going forward? What is their plan? Today in the France 24 debate, we're talking about Putin's no-show in Turkey. With us, former French ambassador to Russia, Jean-Maurice Ripert. Thank you for being with us.
Good evening. Thank you for inviting me.
France 24 International Affairs editor Kedavan Gorgestani has been watching it from start to finish. How are things?
Good.
From Washington, Christine Berzina, managing director of the German Marshall Fund think tank's Geostrategy North Unit. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And from Warsaw, Wojciech Przebelski, president of the Respublika Foundation. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
You can, by the way, listen, like, and subscribe to the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. Nothing's going to happen until Putin and I get together. Donald Trump en route to Dubai, downplaying the absence of his Russian counterpart in Istanbul. This after Volodymyr Zelensky had challenged Putin to that sit down. Emerald Maxwell has more.
It won't be the high-level face-to-face talks Volodymyr Zelensky hoped for. After Vladimir Putin swerved the Ukrainian president's challenge to meet in Istanbul and sent a second-tier team of aides to direct peace talks between the two countries.
After we understood the level of the Russian delegation, we see that, unfortunately, they're taking the talks very unseriously. So far, we do not see among those present anyone who can actually make decisions. Even though, let me remind you, it was Russia who proposed direct negotiations.
In contrast, Zelensky said the high-level Ukrainian delegation was being headed by his defense minister, and that its aim is to attempt at least the first steps towards ending the war, namely a ceasefire. Zelensky also called Russia's move a lack of respect towards President Erdogan of Turkey, which is hosting the talks, and to President Donald Trump, who sent his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, and indicated he was prepared to show up himself until Putin said he wasn't going. The U.S. president later appeared to concede that progress in Turkey was unlikely.
Nothing's going to happen until Putin and I get together, okay? I don't believe anything's going to happen, whether you like it or not, until he and I get together, but we're going to have to get it solved because too many people are dying.
The Russian side is being led by Vladimir Medinsky, a hawkish advisor to Putin who led failed talks in 2022 at the start of the war. He said Russia considered Thursday's talks as a continuation of those negotiations. With hopes for a breakthrough dimming, Moscow could face the prospect of intensified international sanctions, threatened by European leaders on a visit to Kyiv last week.
And before we go to our panel, let's go to Istanbul. Even if the heads of state aren't there, delegations are on the banks of the Bosphorus, where we can join correspondent Jasper Mortimer. Jasper, what's the latest?
The latest is it looks very much as if the negotiations between the Ukrainians and the Russians will start not tonight, but tomorrow. The main factor seems to be that Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky wants the Americans to witness the negotiations, as well as the Turks. The Turks are here, but the American delegation still hasn't arrived. the Americans, chiefly Secretary of State Marco Rubio, have been in Antalya today for the NATO ministerial meeting. They're expected to come here tonight, and then there will be four-party talks, but basically between the Ukrainians and the Russians, with the Turks and the Americans sitting in sometime tomorrow.
Do we know what they're talking about at this point?
Well, they're supposed to be talking about a peace deal. I imagine the Russians are going to push for major territorial concessions from the Ukrainians. The Russian delegation, which is headed by Vladimir Zelensky, as you pointed out, is a hardliner Russian who doesn't think that Ukraine deserves to exist. However, the Ukrainians will push for an immediate ceasefire.
Jasper Mortimer reporting live there from Istanbul. Many thanks for that update. Christine Brezina, your thoughts on what these talks are about? Just photo ops, what we'll see on Friday?
I think there could have been a breakthrough today. That isn't going to happen. The fact that you have President Trump just a few hours' flight away from Turkey set a stage for potential progress. But Putin's lack of desire to arrive himself or to send a delegation, even on diplomatic parity with the ones that are being sent by the other three countries, by Ukraine, the United States, and Turkey, is a snub to this process. And so in many ways, if there is a conversation, it is not going to lead to much further progress. And instead, we can look at this week in many ways as a setback for a quick deal, which is already a slower deal than what President Trump had wanted from the very beginning. It does not look like Russia is in a position to want to make any concessions right now and wants to extract more from the United States in particular to get to the point of conversation.
But Christine, when you woke up in Washington this morning, did you honestly think Vladimir Putin would show up in Turkey?
Not this morning. But again, this is something that has evolved very quickly across this week. This meeting was proposed only last weekend in response to the coalition of the willing, to the European leaders going to Kyiv and threatening new sanctions on Russia for the war. So the situation has evolved tremendously just in the past week. From before the meeting in Kyiv to the big high-level meeting in Kyiv to the announcement of conversations and stalling by Putin, but maybe for the potential of conversation, having Trump within striking distance and being able to participate, and then all of it falling apart in less than a week shows the quick-moving and in many ways unpredictable nature of this diplomatic process.
And meanwhile, over in Moscow this Thursday, the too busy to go to Turkey, Vladimir Putin, instead meeting with Peter Fradkov, the head of, according to Wikipedia, Russia's 10th largest bank, PSB, or Promsvyaz Bank. Jean-Maurice Ripert, your reaction to those images there of Putin instead meeting with somebody who's unknown to most Russians?
To be honest with you, I'm not surprised at all. We know that Putin doesn't want peace. Putin wants the destruction of Ukraine. We know it. Everybody knows it, except it seems Mr. Trump. And I'm sorry to say that I don't care about the words by Donald Trump. He's only talking. The only time where he had direct talks on the issue itself with Putin, he went out of the room, putting forward the preconditions that Putin was formulating. He offered Zelensky capitulation. So,
offered capitulation?
To Ukraine. Capitulation of Ukraine. He said, why not to refuse NATO engagement? We don't need the Europeans on the ground. We don't need a ceasefire. We need to understand that you have no card, Mr. Zelensky. You should give up on your territories. So I'm not surprised at all. Let's be honest. He wants to go back to a world where he would be free to decide on the future of the neighbors of Russia, I was almost ready to say USSR. It's a true problem. At the same time, let's recognize that Zelensky has accepted for 2 months now, since the 11th of March, I think, all the conditions put forward by Trump. Why is Trump not recognizing that the problem is not Ukraine, but Trump, but Putin? This is the only way. And by the way, one last word. As a professional diplomat that I was for 40 years, those were not negotiations in any case. Those were discussions. Huh? Mm. You prepare for negotiations. You just don't go into a room and solve a problem in 2 minutes, especially when the problem lasts for the last 12 years. 2014, I was in Moscow when they invaded and annexed Crimea. So we need discussions. Let's hope, that's my only hope, that if somebody meets somebody else tomorrow, they could be the start of a beginning of something between second-ranking officials from both parts.
Kate von Gorgestani?
I think one of the things to watch out for, and I think that's what Zelensky was trying to play there, because obviously it was Putin who said direct talks. Now, Putin didn't say, I'm going to come, but he did put the direct talks on the table, and Vladimir Zelensky called his bluff and said, okay, I'll be there. And he pushed Vladimir Putin into the position of, well, clearly I'm doing everything that Donald Trump wants and you are not. And what it seems like is that Vladimir Zelensky, with the help of the Europeans, is slowly trying to push Donald Trump to realize not only that Vladimir Putin doesn't want peace, but that Vladimir Putin is playing him. And I think that strategy works better with the character of Donald Trump than simply saying that Vladimir Putin doesn't
want
peace.
Is it working, that strategy?
You're starting to see little signs of frustration. You heard a couple of weeks ago Donald Trump say for the first time, not in those exact words, I can't remember what words he used, but saying something like, Vladimir Putin may be trying to play me, which is something that Donald Trump does not want. And Vladimir Zelensky earlier today in his press conference, when he pointed out, he said, this is not just disrespect to us, it's disrespect to Erdogan and it's disrespect to Donald Trump. Those words are clearly a strategy by Zelensky. If he's not going to get his way by putting out the diplomatic reality, which is that Vladimir Putin doesn't want peace, he's going to go in the way of trying to get Donald Trump to react on character, on the fact that he doesn't want to be played by anyone.
All right. And if we could show Exhibit B of how the Russians feel about it, it is the fact that the head of the co-leader of that delegation is Vladimir Medinsky, who was part of those who last met the Ukrainians to negotiate the grain export deal back in 2022. Medinsky, a former culture minister, these are images from 2023. He helped oversee a complete overhaul of history books updated to include the special military operation, as they call the invasion of Ukraine, and replete with a greater Russia view of the past. What are your thoughts, Wojciech Chybielski, on the fact that he has sent an ideologue to Istanbul?
Well, it shows an intention, a very clear intention of, first of all, not accomplishing any form of a peace deal, let alone a ceasefire, but continuing the war effort in the light of the ideology that keeps the power circle in Kremlin where it is. The trouble with the position, the political position of Vladimir Putin, is that should he stop or even achieve peace, if he stop with a ceasefire or achieve an honest deal in this potential negotiations, his own position as a politician within the power circle and legitimacy inside of the country would be in jeopardy. And that is the reason why the type of activities that we see is just a window dressing that he's willing to demonstrate in order to protract a full scale support for Ukraine, for Ukrainian survival. The game for Russia is not Ukraine alone. As we read on the official statements from a month ago on the Russian military intelligence website press release, The trouble is Eurofascism, which is located in France and Britain today. This is how Russia defines a clear enemy. And by the way, it does not stop in Europe, but it goes much further and is essentially targeting the Western U.S. Domination, which exhibits of Xi Jinping in Moscow, saying they are friends of steel and their friendship was forged in fire. Also, the past 3 years of the ongoing invasion is a clear demonstration that these two capitals are very serious of undermining rule-based order that the West advocates and stands behind.
All right, so no going back. It's the military option or bust when it comes to Vladimir Putin. Jean-Maurice Ripert, we have breaking news, which is Vladimir Putin has just sacked the chief of the Russian military's land forces. Something that we've seen regularly since the full-scale
invasion. It's interesting because it reminds us also that contrary to what a lot of people are saying, and I'm talking under the control of Wojciech, for instance, Russia in 3 years of war has gained, 5% more of territories that they had gained in 2014? He has not won the war. And he will not win the war. Doesn't mean that Ukraine will win the war. Nobody will win on the military side. So it's a no-way-out solution for Putin, in my view. But it's obvious that he's not satisfied. And that's the only things that autocrats know how to do. When somebody is displeased, you sack him if you don't kill him, which usually in Russia is also one solution. But let me say something. Putin is a pathological liar. Remember, a few days ago, on the 9th of May, he said, truth, unilateral, truth. Since that day, he has...
Truth.
Yeah. Sorry for my English. Since that day, he has killed hundreds of civilians. You have seen images of bombs, of drones, attacks on hospitals, on schools, on streets, women, elderly, children. That's what he's doing. He's lying. And it seems that Mr. Trump is the only one not understanding that.
But do you agree with Kevin Gorgiastani on that Trump is starting to feel like he's being
played? I hope first that he does, and I hope that he's in a position to do so.
After meeting Zelensky, Turkey's president saying he's up for hosting direct talks once Putin and Zelensky are ready. Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who canceled appearance before the microphones after seeing how things played out. He, as always, holds a lot of cards in all this. NATO member, buys Russian gas, civilian nukes, controls access to the Black Sea through the Bosphorus Straits. Turkey submarines that have to surface if they're going through those Bosphorus Strait. That's the way it's been for decades. Turkey, with its 355,000 troops, the largest NATO force outside the United States, and which also has a booming arms trade among its customers, not Russia, but Ukraine, including Corvette warships, which has periodically drawn criticism from Moscow. Since they knew the U.S. Secretary of State would be in town, we're getting the opposite noises from those NATO ministers who are there to talk about. We'll talk more about that in a moment. But let me ask Christine Brezina this: what role for Turkey at this particular point?
Turkey is the linchpin for so many of these conversations. It is a crucial ally and is definitely increasing its profile across NATO and globally in these negotiations and in general more recently. Its bigger role in the Middle East, now that there has been a change in leadership and in status in Syria, makes Turkey a much more significant regional power looking down towards the Middle East. And Turkey has playing this very important role on NATO defense issues. The Secretary General of NATO, Mark Rutte, was in Turkey just also a few days ago. Now he is receiving these high-level negotiations. Turkey is capable of having a very strong backbone to Russia. Turkey is a NATO country that shot down a Russian jet that had violated Turkey's airspace just a little over than a decade ago. And that led to tensions, but not active conflict between the two sides.
And when you heard,
and so Turkey is a respected power by the Russians.
And when you heard Donald Trump, while in the Gulf, gushing about Recep Tayyip Erdogan, particularly in the context of that normalization of ties with Syria under Assad, an ally of Moscow, which would you say, when push comes to shove, Trump is more of a kindred spirit with Putin or Erdogan?
Trump is a kindred spirit with leaders who are able to exercise muscle and have influence on the world stage. Trump respects power, and he respects a fear factor. Putin certainly inspires fear among the Russian people. And Erdogan also has a very muscular style of leadership. But Erdogan is an ally, and NATO is an ally. And so currently we're seeing Erdogan playing a very constructive role on issues that Trump cares about. And Putin is not. And so who is the closer friend today? Today, it's Erdogan. But it's a very, again, changeable situation when it comes to that whole range of conflicts around the world.
Kedavan Gorgestani, it can get awfully crowded around the Black Sea.
It can, but I do think that Turkey does have that sort of geopolitical clout that we were talking about that sort of distinguishes or gives it a leg up over Russia. And Erdogan has shown that he can be someone to help out Donald Trump in his deals and what he's trying to do in the Middle East. And so I think that if you take two people who have the sort of strongman look, the army, the military power, but you add the geopolitical clout, I think Erdogan sort of wins out that sort of battle between the strongmen. That said, as we all know, Donald Trump is not very consistent. And one day he can be on one side, the next day he can be on the other side. But it seems that in the past months, Erdogan has slowly built that sort of trust of Donald Trump. And an extra thing that Erdogan has going for him is that back in the United States, Donald Trump has sort of two wings in his party. You have the MAGA crowd that sort of, we don't want to get involved in foreign problems, but you still have those sort of so-called traditional Republicans, those hawks that are hawks towards Russia. And so they are also people who are pushing Donald Trump towards Turkey rather than towards Russia. Whether they will win out is another question, but that's sort of what is happening there.
Wojciech Przybylski, how should Ukrainians today, with, again, this strength in Turkey, particularly since that handshake between Donald Trump and Syria's Ahmad al-Shara earlier in the week, how should they view Turkey? How should the Ukrainians view Turkey?
Well, I think they already recognize Turkey as a global, regionally growing power. It's a regional power that has aspirations.
But should they be seeing them as a mediator or an ally?
Well, I think they can see Turkey as ally at times. And also a stabilizer, kind of a middle ground for discussion with everyone else. That's how Turkey has been growing. Essentially, as my colleagues already demonstrated in their arguments and illustrations, Turkey is playing with everyone. And it's indispensable in the region, in the Black Sea region. It is part of the alliance, of NATO alliance, but at the same time, it does not like U.S. presence all around. And it sees that it would like increased influence in the region, including Ukraine. And Ukraine, I think, has been from already a number of years allowing a bit more of Turkish influence in the form of support, but also in prospective investments of rebuilding Ukraine, to be also present in Ukraine. And there are clear interests Turkey has, especially given the Black Sea and Crimea, but also the economic revival that Ukraine wants will see, and Turkey will want to benefit from it.
Is there a scenario, Jean-Maurice Ripert, where Recep Tayyip Erdogan misplays his hand, particularly when it comes to Vladimir Putin?
I think we should not overestimate what Erdogan can do. I have been the EU ambassador to Turkey for a few years ago. First, remember, he is an autocrat himself. He has a very complicated internal political situations, imprisoning opponents with demonstrations in the streets of the major cities in Turkey. The economy of Turkey is down the drill. This is clear. So his means, what is it? The army. Okay, now he has a truce with the PKK, which is good, the Kurdish movement. But he has always played everybody at the same time. Remember, he was buying some missiles from the Russians while he a few years ago, while he was still a member, he's still a member of NATO. I think what is interesting is the fact that Turkey, like Brazil or like India, are the proof that the emerged new powers want to be in a position to play a role, to be sitting at the table of the major powers, to be part of the decision-making process, but they don't want to choose in between the so-called, until now, superpowers. So they will play one day Russia, one day there will be agreements with Washington, the next day with the EU. Don't forget that Turkey is still a candidate to the accession to EU, which limits also his relations. It's quite complicated. So don't overestimate. He can be the host of talks, and I think it's... Don't forget something else, I'm sorry. But the Russians are not very happy with what Erdogan has done during the last years in Central Asia, where he's competing to play a role, competing against the Russians, and the Chinese, by the way. Everybody's fighting in Central Asia to get some oil, to get some gas, to get some power.
To sell some weapons.
To sell some weapons. And don't forget also that he was the man behind the aggression, let's be honest, of Azerbaijan against Armenia, that Russia was supposed to be the peacekeeper. It was a rebuke to Lavrov, who had negotiated some truce and was supposedly sent some peace troops from Russia. And Erdogan just decided that enough was enough, that Baku should get back on Okarabah, and it didn't please the Russians. So he's not completely reliable, neither for Moscow, neither for Washington, in my view, which doesn't mean he cannot play a role, but probably less important than we can think or we can hope.
All right, and that leaves, of course, another player in all this, and that is Europe. And we saw that... Yes. Since they knew the U.S. Secretary of State would be coming to Turkey, the foreign ministers of NATO decided to show up. First, we had that sit-down of the top diplomats of France, Germany, Italy, the U.K. In Antalya alongside the NATO Secretary General. Then there was a sort of an informal NATO summit that took place. The Europeans who've been shoring up existing sanctions against Russia... What with Donald Trump's views uncertain, they've been particularly eyeing the frozen assets. And during a television interview on Monday, France's president was asked about Warsaw's request that Paris extend its nuclear umbrella to Poland.
The Americans have bombs on planes in Belgium, Germany, Italy and Turkey. We are ready to open this discussion. I will define the framework in a very official way in the weeks and months to come, but we have already engaged in this with the reservations that I've mentioned. That is to say, we will not finance it.
C'est pas nous qui finançons, ça ne vient pas en soustraction de ce qu'on a.
Wojciech Chybielski, if I could borrow an expression from the Cold War, how good is Emmanuel Macron in talking the language of deterrence?
First, Emmanuel Macron and Donald Tusk have signed the bilateral treaty renewing the Polish-French relations, including the security guarantees, which is a great achievement in building a French vision for Europe. I mean, that's a Europe that becomes more and more a power, and this element of nuclear deterrence that Poland also hoped for is also demonstrating the power France have in shaping the strategic position of Europe overall, because this is happening within exactly the framework of European Union and NATO, but European Union specifically. And this this move is very much regarded as in Poland as a potential new opening for more of European power in the future, looking at the potential that can be done either bilaterally. And remember, the European Union is opening negotiations also with Great Britain on the security framework cooperation, or exactly through these multilateral formats. That's overall, my reading of that is very good, very promising, and it does not solve the global problems, but in the scale of Europe, we have to recognize it's not the superpower, of course. It delivers a lot in terms of stability and the prospect of deterrence.
Delivers a lot. Jean-Maurice Hoppe also kind of spooks citizens a little bit when we start talking about nuclear weapons.
No, what the president said, the French president said, was that in the French doctrine, the use of nuclear forces is a deterrence and will be decided only upon examining the vital interest of France. What is important is the fact that the vital interest of France could include the protection of allies. This is fundamental. And I think what has been said by Wojciech is very important. The union between France, Germany, the UK, of course, which is for this purpose part of the of Europe, of course, and Poland is key for the future of Ukraine. Remember something, I'm sorry to go to figures for 2 minutes. The European Union and the member states have delivered more than $135 billion since the beginning of the war 3 years ago, which is more than the United States, which is more than 50% of the total aid that Ukraine has received. So we are a player. And more than that, sorry, very short, more than that, only Europe, in the conditions we know between Russia and the US, will be in a position to secure any kind of peace agreement. This is what Zelensky wants. This is what Ukrainian wants. This is what we should want and do.
Kerevan Gorgestani.
I just wanted to add something to that. The first time Emmanuel Macron mentioned this idea of sort of sharing France's nuclear power, for lack of a better word, it's obviously not exactly sharing, but that idea dates back to early March, which was just a little bit after that speech by J.D. Vance at the Munich Security Conference and Donald Trump doubling down on this idea that, you know, they were going to let Europe deal with their own security issues. So it was a sort of reaction to that situation, to the fact that Donald Trump was upending years, decades of this transatlantic alliance. And this is simply continuing in that road. And we've seen sort of the concrete steps with the Poles going forward. But the idea really reemerged after the Americans showed that at the time, there was this question of, are they still reliable allies or not? And that was when Emmanuel Macron started talking about that.
Christine Brezina, what reactions, if any, inside the beltway of Washington where you are?
On the question of nuclear sharing and deterrence, or more broadly?
On Emmanuel Macron saying that if it's in France's interests, they're going to extend the Paris's nuclear umbrella to members east. He was ambiguous on to whom, but listening to Wojciech, it's clear that the Poles say they're included in that.
We're in a transformational moment in Washington on the question of what is desirable for European defense. The Trump administration has come in with a mandate on Europe to do a lot more to take responsibility for its own defense. In the past, a reliance on the United States for critical capabilities was a desirable thing, even though there was continual rhetoric on Europeans needing to pay more, do more, purchase more. There's a shift in this economic relationship to one that really does prioritize Europe's ability to act, to free up American resources, including nuclear resources, probably, to be more available to deal with conflicts in other parts of the world, which means that there is perhaps a greater opening right now to have backing or even quiet approval of greater European nuclear sharing, more so than you would have seen in the past. I don't think this is a done deal. Of course, there are many parts of the administration, and even J.D. Vance in the Munich Security Conference here in Washington last week was interested in the ongoing weapons sale and economic elements of the transatlantic security relationship. It is very much not a clear picture about what this relationship will be a few years down the line. But this moment will see the least resistance, I believe, on this issue than any time in the last few decades.
Jean-Maurice,
yeah, if I may just add two or three things to what Katifana said a few minutes ago. There are other elements which are very important to take into account in considering that what President Macron said is very important. First, I think the British are realizing that the threat by Donald Trump that you were mentioning to withdraw in a way, not from NATO, but to question the automaticity of the protection of NATO, is endangering the UK itself, because they had, for different reasons since the last war, for 80 years now, placed part of their nuclear capacity under the control of the Americans. So it's not only about Americans intervening, it's also they are no more sure that they would be able to decide alone and independently of the use to their own capacity. Second evolution, which is key, the change in the German position. Since the last war, remember, you're too young perhaps, but decades ago, the Chancellor Kohl, I think, said to Mitterrand, okay, it's good to talk about nuclear tactical weapons, but tell me, where will be the theater? Where would those bombs fall? Meaning Germany. Mm. Now the situation is completely different. But to hear a German chancellor calling for Franco-German cooperation in the nuclear space is a revolution. And third point, of course, the fact that other major countries, like Poland, of course, are joining France and Germany, and we should support the rebirth of the Weimar Triangle, I think, in this respect. This is also a very important evolution, which shows that we should take that seriously.
Wojciech Cebelski, we can add to that an interview given by the new Chancellor of Germany to the Zeit newspaper this Thursday, where he said Germany and its allies will move to confiscate frozen Russian assets if legally possible. That's a big caveat, if legally possible. Nonetheless, this muscular talk, that's great, but it only works as long as one election cycle, right? Particularly because we have a presidential election in France. I know you have one, a first round of one in Poland on Sunday, and there's one as well in Romania. So this newfound European unity, how solid is it?
I think we need to look from the point of view of citizens and the public opinion. Indeed, there are many now political actors that advocate and take positions which would counter the mainstream politicians, also the use of multilateral formats. You mentioned case of Romania, where a likely victory of Mr. Simeon will undermine the NATO's and EU positioning on deterrence, and also simply the posture we have in defense posture. However, majority of Europeans, also in the countries that do not take such hawkish positions, demand more European effectiveness, more European collaboration in these critical areas like defense. And I believe that those leaders like Mr. Merz can lose if they don't deliver. But if they deliver, and there are some bold moves, including also removing a cap on spending on defense and debt, if that delivers in a number of years, that can consolidate power around such leaders and around such political parties. And that will be a critical point also in fighting off the populist movements or the radical movements, often simply sponsored or amplified by our enemies, be it Russia, be it Iran, be it China, whoever is not in favor of a unified and stronger Europe. But the game is not over.
The game's not over. Christine Brzezina, how this push for a united Europe on defense, what are the chances, really?
Also, better now than ever before. The big shift we're talking about on nuclear and the agreement between France and Poland hasn't come out of the blue. There has been a big change in European defense debates since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine began in 2022. The notion that the era in which economic tools and trade could solve geopolitical problems, that era is clearly over. And so how does Europe show its might? How is Europe able to have an effective deterrent against Russia, which has shown its capacity and willingness to change borders on the European continent in the 21st century? Each individual country in Europe, even the big strong ones, even France with highly capable military, even Poland, which is at close to 5% defense spending with massive armed forces and highly ambitious and responsible procurement practices. Even these two countries are now cooperating more together. So I think the necessity, the external threats that Europe faces are so high that there is a good chance that significant progress is made. Of course, politics get in the way, and of course, there are interpersonal disputes, but there is significant delivery and capabilities that is simply essential for the existence of the countries on the European continent. And cooperation is the most pragmatic and cost-effective way of attaining capabilities and being able to have a true deterrent against adversaries.
All right. With or without boosted Europe, with or without the talks that are taking place right now in Turkey, what is for certain is that on the ground in Ukraine, there's no let-up in fighting. Overnight, there were three civilians killed in the northeastern city of Sumy in a Russian drone strike. And, you know, we played that clip, Kerevan Gorgestani, of Emmanuel Macron. It was a long interview on French television the other night. There was another clip where he said, look, the time for talks is coming, and in that time for talks, Ukraine is going to have to give up some territory.
Look, the issue of territory, there's always this question of, which is what the Russians are telling the Ukrainians. Basically, we want you to recognize the fact that we control and we own those regions, whether it's Crimea or Donetsk or the others. I think there's a big difference, first of all, between what Russia says it wants and what Zelensky says, you know, this is the reality. And there's when I say reality, I mean there's a difference between a diplomatic international recognition that Russia is now controlling these regions and a sort of de facto reality that while we're doing negotiations, yes, there are regions where Russian troops control the ground. Those are two extremely different things. You think about Crimea. How many countries in the world actually recognize that Russia owns Crimea? Not that many. Nobody has recognized. It's been 11 years. Nobody has recognized de facto, yes, it is controlled by Russia. So this idea of, how much territory Zelensky is going to give up. He's not going to give it up just like that. It's going to be a sort of reality on the ground. And the second part of that is the idea of, you know, ask any French person, any Brit, what region would you be willing to give up if we were invaded tomorrow? Those are really hard questions that can't be answered that easily.
But all right, but Jean-Maurice Ripert, when Emmanuel Macron says that Ukraine is going to have to make concessions, what does he mean?
He means exactly what has been explained. We can hope, at best, for a global ceasefire guaranteed by international troops, mainly Europeans, and de facto new frozen conflict. There will be no recognition of the Russian possession. Otherwise, it means it's an open bar. Any power in Europe can go. Mr. Simeon is already threatening, if he wins,
in
to
Romania,
try to get Moldova, which, as you know, has already been partly occupied by Russian troops who have never left since 1991. So it's open bar. This is not acceptable for the Europeans. So Mr. Zelensky will have to accept some sort of frozen conflict for a certain time. But really, I mean, let me say one more word.
Very quickly, because we're out of time.
Yes, we have to understand that the European Union tomorrow that will intervene and support Ukraine could not be Europe with the 27 countries. It will include the UK, of course. Probably other countries like Norway will join. You will have Canada, you will have Japan, you will have Australia, you will have New Zealand. It will be EU plus and EU less. This is the way that the EU will change in the future. This is obvious today. We will not be achieving what we want to do, security and peace and prosperity in Europe all together on every subject. We will have to accept differentiated Europe's.
All right, a Europe so. Plus and a Europe minus. Jean-Maurice Ripert, I want to thank you. I want to thank Kedavan Gorgestani, Christine Brzina for being with us from Washington, Wojciech Przybylski in Warsaw. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.